What drives someone to ride a motorcycle 8,000 miles across America, lift 600 pounds in a single squat, and then spend decades tenderly documenting the inner lives of people locked in neurological prisons? Oliver Sacks lived as if stillness itself were dangerous, as if only through relentless movement, both physical and intellectual, could he outrun the shadows of his own mind. His memoir reveals not just the evolution of a brilliant neurologist, but the anatomy of curiosity itself, restless, hungry, and ultimately redemptive. When his mother called him an abomination for being gay, those words became a wound that would take a lifetime to heal. Yet from that pain emerged something extraordinary, a man who would teach the world to see the humanity in those society deemed broken, precisely because he knew what it meant to feel irreparably different. Picture an 18-year-old circling Regent's Park endlessly, his throttle jammed, brakes failing, unable to stop. This wasn't just mechanical failure, it was a perfect metaphor for Sacks' entire existence. Motorcycles weren't transportation, they were his first language of freedom. While other young men in 1950s London sought status through cars, Sacks joined the Ton-Up Boys at the legendary Ace Cafe, where doing the ton, hitting 100 miles per hour, was the price of admission. His Norton Dominator became an extension of his nervous system, responding to subtle shifts in weight and intention. Years later in California, those Sunday morning rides over the Golden Gate Bridge, smelling eucalyptus, feeling wind-created memories of almost intolerable sweetness. When he rode 700 miles without stopping through Oregon's Crater Lake or Death Valley's moonscape, he wasn't running from something. He was running toward a version of himself that could only exist in motion, where the boundary between rider and machine dissolved into pure sensation. This wasn't recklessness. It was meditation at 100 miles per hour, a way of being fully present that foreshadowed how he would later approach patients with complete immersion and attention. Oxford should have been paradise for a brilliant young scientist. Instead, it became exile. Sacks failed his preliminary exams 3 times, not from lack of intelligence, but from a mind that refused disciplinary boundaries. Yet in Queen's College Library's underground stacks, discovering Darwin's original editions and Thomas Brown's magnificent prose, Sacks found his true education. His friendship with Kalman Cohen, a mathematical logician whose focused mind complemented Sacks' wildly associative one, showed him that intellectual partnership could bridge incompatible thinking styles. When his research collapsed, his parents sent him to Ein HaShofet, a kibbutz near Haifa. There, physical labor transformed him. He lost 60 pounds and discovered something profound. His body wasn't a vehicle for his brain, it was inseparable from his thinking itself. This revolution would revolutionize how he understood neurological patients, seeing them not as broken machines, but as whole people navigating altered embodiments. At Muscle Beach in Venice, Sacks became Dr. Squat, matching Olympic lifter Dave Ashman to 550 pounds, then pushing to 575. The discipline demanded total presence, the union of intention and action. The price came later, ruptured quadriceps tendons in 1974 and 1984. Hospitalized alongside Dave Shepard, they looked at their damaged bodies. Dave said simply, "What fools we were." But had they learned something essential about inhabiting a body fully, accepting both its power and its fragility? Medical school shattered Sacks' Oxford illusions. When Joshua, a young swimmer with leukemic nerve infiltrations, tried jumping from a hospital balcony, Sacks pulled him back. Days later, dying in agony, Joshua said, "You shouldn't have pulled me back." That moment revealed medicine wasn't pure science. These were passionate individuals with agonizing questions no diagnosis could answer. His neurological training under two brilliant opposites taught him good medicine required both approaches. Intuitive Kremer could diagnose rare conditions at a glance through pure observation. Methodical Gilliatt demanded systematic examination of physiological mechanisms. Sacks absorbed both, learning art and science were complementary ways of seeing. Arriving in San Francisco in 1960, the city felt like permission itself. Working with neurosurgeons Grant Levin and Bert Feinstein, he joined a cross-disciplinary team including engineers, physicists, and visiting physiologists, the environment Oxford had denied him. He attended conferences where he saw his idol, Aldous Huxley, nearly blind but brilliant, and Arthur Koestler, with his face ostentatiously lined, seamed with great furrows of anguish and intelligence. Here was medicine as it should be, rigorous, collaborative, and unafraid of big questions.
In 1966, Sachs encountered 80 patients at Beth Abraham Hospital, survivors of the 1920s encephalitis lethargica pandemic, frozen in Parkinsonian states for decades. Behind their statuesque appearances lived intact minds, consciousness suspended but not extinguished. When L-DOPA became available in 1969, patients immobile for 40 years burst into explosive life. But complications followed immediately: unpredictable fluctuations, extreme sensitivity, bizarre reactions. Nothing existed between too much and too little. These patients demolished the divide between neurology and psychiatry, displaying Parkinsonism, tics, compulsions, obsessions, gusts of passion. Their awakenings weren't merely physical, but intellectual, perceptual, emotional, a global animation contradicting compartmentalized brain function. Sachs discovered Luria's Mind of a Mnemonist, initially thinking it was a novel before realizing it was the deepest case history he'd encountered, combining classical science with romantic storytelling. That summer in London, Sachs wrote each afternoon, then read installments to his mother. She was both emotional listener and sharp critic. The medical profession responded with strange mutism, but general readers recognized something unprecedented, science that honored the full humanity of its subjects. Everything changed when Mr. I, a 65-year-old artist, wrote to Sachs after becoming completely colorblind following a car accident. He hadn't just lost the ability to see color, he'd lost the ability to imagine it. Even his dreams were colorless. This revealed damage to specialized brain areas that construct color, showing the brain as an active creator rather than passive receiver. At a 1986 conference, Francis Crick pulled Sachs aside. "Tell me stories." Each case sparked bursts of hypotheses. Working with Mr. I shifted Sachs from naive realism towards seeing the brain as essentially constructive. Then he discovered Gerald Edelman's neural Darwinism, a revolutionary theory proposing that natural selection-like processes operate within individual brains. Genes couldn't specify every neural connection. Experiences strengthen certain connections while weakening others. Edelman's concept liberated Sachs from computer analogies, offering a rich biological framework for consciousness. Every perception is an act of creation. This explained his patients' altered perceptions, not deficits, but different ways of constructing reality, equally valid windows into how consciousness emerges from neural activity. Throughout everything, Sachs remained ink-stained, accumulating nearly 1,000 journals. He kept notebooks everywhere, beside his bed for dreams, by swimming pools where thoughts emerged fully formed. Though he rarely reviewed them, writing clarified his thoughts and feelings, an indispensable form of talking to himself. At its best, writing transported him to total absorption, oblivious to time's passage. Despite millions of words over 70 years, the act remained as fresh and joyful as when he began. This compulsive documentation was how he made sense of a world that constantly overwhelmed him, processing everything from patients' neurological transformations to his own struggles with identity and belonging. At 77, after a lifetime of solitude, Sachs met Billy. Their friendship deepened until Billy said, "I have conceived a deep love for you." Sachs recognized he felt the same, his eyes filling with tears. This relationship required geological changes in his lifetime habits of self-absorption. Near the end, he finally found the acceptance he'd been seeking, not from the world, but from himself. Sachs Life reveals something radical. Our supposed deficits aren't obstacles, but essential parts of who we are. The outsider at Oxford became the world's most beloved neurologist precisely because he never fit in. The man who couldn't stop moving, on motorcycles, lifting weights, swimming, riding, discovered that consciousness itself is movement, perpetual creation, endless becoming. In a world demanding we fix what's broken, Sachs showed us how to celebrate what's beautifully different. Your strangeness isn't something to cure. It's your way of being fully, courageously alive.